This week on The Score, what brought about the end of the Cold War? Will an inclusive economy eliminate poverty? Can the United States counterbalance China and Russia in Africa? Is the Ninth Amendment more than an ink blot? All this and more on The Score. Don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere. Merry Christmas from The Score with Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Later today, we'll hear National Security Advisor John Bolton talk about Africa policy. But first, let's look at 20th century history. Earlier this week, the Charlottesville History Club hosted a lecture on the topic of Ronald Reagan and the Cold War. Professor Melvin Loeffler, a prize-winning historian from the University of Virginia, talked about Reagan's nearly obsessive goals of eliminating nuclear weapons and ending the Cold War with the Soviet Union. In the process of ending the Cold War, Professor Loeffler said, Reagan helped win it. After the lecture, I asked Professor Loeffler about the strategic history of the 1980s, including the nuclear freeze movement and SDI, or Star Wars. Almost up until the actual end of the Cold War, virtually nobody predicted that it was going to happen. What explains that?
The Cold War was so deeply rooted in the national DNA, you might say, of both the Soviet Union and the United States, that it was very hard for people on both sides to think that they could extricate themselves from the dynamics that existed. Moreover, and very importantly, each side saw the other as ideologically inspired and intent on destroying the fundamentals of the system of the other. So is that deep-seated ideological suspicion coupled with decades of rivalry and geopolitical and geostrategic friction that made it incomprehensible for people to think that there would be the end of the Cold War?
One of the phenomena of the early to mid-1980s was the nuclear freeze movement. And I wonder whether the participants in that would have known that Ronald Reagan thought that they were aiming low.
No, the participants would not have thought that. The participants looked with incredible suspicion whenever Reagan would talk about his own desire to ratchet down the arms race. The nuclear freeze movement people had reason to feel that way because what they were seeing was a tremendous buildup of American conventional and strategic capabilities. Hence, they could not imagine that it was Reagan's real desire to bring about a reduction of armaments. In truth, it seems pretty clear to me that Reagan did honestly believe that by building strength, he would subsequently be able to negotiate much more effectively for the types of cuts and reductions that many in the nuclear freeze movement could not have believed possible.
Well, what was the impact of the Strategic Defense Initiative on the end of the Cold War?
That's a deeply controversial issue. I think that most Americans assign far too much importance to the Strategic Defense Initiative. As I said in my lecture tonight, most Soviet leaders including Gorbachev himself and including Gorbachev's most important advisor, Anatoly Chernyayev, denied that SDI played a determinative role. What is clear is that SDI did have an impact, at least at the margins, on many middle-level Soviet officials and military officers. But I would say that the majority of scholars today do not think that SDI was a determinative factor shaping Soviet behavior.
But SDI seems to have been a component of Reagan's thinking that it would be a way to reduce the destructiveness of war if nuclear weapons could not actually be reduced on the ground.
Well, Reagan sincerely felt that mutual assured destruction was a ridiculous way to defend a nation. And so it seems clear to me, at least, that Reagan personally sincerely believed that if you could design a defensive system, and he knew that it would be incredibly difficult to do so, and he said that numerous times, but that if you could design such a system, it would make sense to do so. He said repeatedly, and very few people believed him, that he would be willing to share SDI technology. Once again, as I said in my remarks tonight, it seems evident to me now, and I think to many scholars, that Reagan sincerely meant it when he said he would share SDI technology. But none of his advisors thought that that would ever happen, and clearly Gorbachev himself and Reagan's Soviet interlocutors thought that he was in fairyland, as they often said, when he talked about sharing SDI technology. But once again, I think Reagan really did believe that if the United States developed an effective system, he would be willing to share it.
You've been studying these issues for a very long time. What is it like as a historian to be able to access information that was completely unavailable at the time that these events were taking place?
It's absolutely fascinating. It's what inspires me as a scholar and as a historian, that you can actually get to see records that you never would have imagined seeing. This is true of the records of our own decision makers, and even more true when you think about obtaining access to the records of Soviet leaders and of communist leaders inside the countries of Hungary and Poland and East Germany. Many scholars have done extensive research in those records, and they've contributed enormously to my own understanding of the end of the Cold War.
And was there anything that you found in those recently available documents that upended some of your thoughts about what happened in the 1980s?
What I think is most significant is to understand the motivations and preoccupations of Mikhail Gorbachev. He clearly was the determinative agent in bringing about the end of the Cold War. As important as Reagan and George H.W. Bush were, Gorbachev was undoubtedly the most important agent bringing about the end of the Cold War. What's interesting is to see the way Gorbachev wrestled with very conflicting impulses. Gorbachev, what impressed me in some of the records that I was able to assess was the degree to which Gorbachev honestly wrestled with the issue of, you know, whether Soviet security actually would be endangered by the erosion of communist governments inside Eastern Europe, or by the unification of Germany inside NATO. You can see Gorbachev just, and his advisors, wrestling very, very thoughtfully and in many ways in agonizing ways about these issues that were of enormous importance to them. They wanted to bring about reform, but they also feared that many of these reforms could have the potential of endangering Soviet security. One of the most important things in understanding the history of the Cold War is to understand the persistent Soviet fear of Soviet of encirclement of the Soviet Union. One of the most important things, this cannot be overstated, as I mentioned in the lecture tonight, was the preoccupation with the growth of German power and the prospect that Germany might once again try to dominate all of Europe and endanger the security of the Soviet Union. One of the things that Gorbachev wrestles with is the new Germany likely to be a peaceful Germany? It has been now, Gorbachev recognized, for almost two generations. He recognized in 1985, but will it continue to be that way? And many of his advisors were extremely suspicious about the future of Germany. Keep in mind that many Westerners were. Margaret Thatcher opposed the unification of Germany inside NATO because she, as an English woman who had lived through World War II, just like Soviet leaders who lived through World War II, just had deeply, deeply suspicious feelings about the revival of German power.
And nobody in 1988 would have predicted that 30 years later the leader of Germany would be somebody from the former East Germany.
That's for certain.
Thank you, Professor Lefler.
Thanks so much.
Happy holidays from The Score with Rick Sincere.
It's December, and the time of year for reflection on the previous 12 months. TV and radio chat shows are filled with retrospectives of 2018, so why not here on The Score, too? I got together with Young Voices contributor Kayla Stetzel at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington a few days ago, and together we reminisced about the past year in politics and culture, including the midterm elections and some of the prominent personalities who emerged in 2018.
We're getting towards the end of 2018. When the year began, what did you think would be the big stories that would be in the headlines at the end of the year?
For me, the apex, what I thought was going to be the biggest story of the year, I still think it's a huge deal, is the nuclear summit. When Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump met each other in Singapore, I thought, there's nothing that could ever possibly top this. This is a crazy world event. It's going to be one of those things that people read about in history books, and I still think that will be true, right? But this year's gone on to be so insane that I almost kind of forget that happened, that really happened.
Yeah, and nothing really came of it, did it?
Yeah, nothing really came of it, which for me wasn't a surprise. I'm not one to trust North Korea. It seemed like an interesting photo opportunity, I think, for the Koreans. And yeah, I mean, going into the Trump presidency, tensions were very high between him and North Korea. A lot of fighting words on Twitter, Rocket Man, etc. So for the fact that they met, shook hands, and tried to reach an agreement in person just blew my mind. But yeah, nothing really came of it, for sure.
Speaking of Korea, in September, President Trump and President Moon of South Korea signed an enhanced U.S.-Korea free trade agreement, which may or may not have benefited the United States more than Korea. But that was really the first of the trade agreements that have been new and improved under the Trump trade policy. How do you think the Trump administration's shift in attitudes towards foreign trade has affected the United States?
Well, I'm a huge advocate of free trade, obviously, so I've been extremely upset with Trump's trade policies. His tariff plans have all been disastrous for the country in a number of different ways. I think GM's closing in Ohio and pivot away from manufacturing in the U.S. is an example of how his trade policies have failed us as a country. Yeah, I mean, there's numerous facets I could go into, but just in general, I think his trade policies have really hurt the end consumer.
and hurt a lot of people who voted for him.
Oh, absolutely. Especially, I mean, I'm from the Midwest, so the Rust Belt area. And a lot of people who I know who voted for Trump were like, okay, he's going to get our jobs back. He's going to help the Midwest, help the little guys, right? That's why they wanted a strongman president. But when it came right down to it, these tariffs directly hurt steelworkers and a lot of the small businesses in the United States.
And farmers as well. I heard from the Minneapolis Fed, the Federal Reserve Bank, that in their area of their geographic coverage area, there were 84 farmers that went bankrupt, which is about five times as many as would normally happen in a year.
Yeah, I mean, it's really sad. I know that there's a lot of tariffs on soy products. Soy farmers are getting hit really hard. But yeah, just across the board, a lot of the staple American industries, or what you think of as American industries, are being hurt by his tariff policies. So for me, that's like my number one, probably one of my number one grievances against Trump administration is his tariffs.
What do you think are some of the highlights of the Trump administration in the past year? What good things did they do?
Interesting. I seldom ever think of highlights. By nature, I'm very critical of most things that happen in the government sphere. Yeah, good things. I mean, I really do think that kind of opening up a more robust dialogue with North Korea, while it might have backfired, I think it's always kind of been the step in the right direction. Backfire might be a little bit too strong. I don't really think it did much, but the fact that we were able to sit down with a head of state that's always been deemed to be extremely unstable and actually have a conversation is a positive thing, right? We opened up a previously just totally iced off and closed off communication channel. So even though it didn't go to plan, I think that's something he needs credit for sure.
I was at a lecture last night where a historian talked about Ronald Reagan's role in ending the Cold War. And he made a distinction between ending the Cold War and winning the Cold War. And one of the things that Reagan's aides attributed to him were a policy of strength, realism, and negotiation. Mm-hmm. And Reagan was always willing to negotiate with foreign adversaries to accomplish what he really wanted, which was the elimination of nuclear weapons and the end of the Cold War.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think, as much as Trump loves talking about how great he is at deal-making, I don't think he's at Reagan standard, but the fact that he was able to sit down at a table and talk in person certainly a step in the right direction, in my opinion.
This was an election year, the midterm elections. Every member of the House, a third of the Senate, lots of governors, state legislatures were up for election or re-election. What is your takeaway from the midterm elections? What were your what do you think was the most important lesson we should learn from it, and what thing did you learn that you didn't expect you would be learning?
For me, there was no real shocks with this election. I was expecting moderate gains in the House for the Democrats, as is common when the Republicans have the White House. I didn't expect a blue wave per se, more of like a blue trickle, which is kind of what we saw. But what makes me so excited about this midterm cycle particularly is the growth and diversity. Record number of female candidates, record number of LGBTQ candidates, and more millennial candidates as well, which is exciting for me. Regardless of politics, I think it's really comforting and interesting to see our representative politics starting to look more like the United States.
Yeah, the first openly gay male governor was elected in Colorado. The first congressman elected through ranked choice voting was elected in Maine. So there are changes happening and that we'll be watching for the next few years.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, a lot of people, it was a very polarizing election. Obviously, we're living in a very divided time, right? But I think that's something that really should be celebrated, regardless of where you stand politically. It should be interesting to see moving forward how that ends up shaping our body politic.
Aside from, you know, actually losing their seats,
yes,
who do you think were the big losers in the midterm elections?
Interesting. You know, I was really interested to see what was going to happen in Texas. I personally didn't think Beto could pull it off and win Texas, just because it wasn't because I didn't have faith in Beto and the public's love of Beto, but Texas is a red state. But he got so close to winning, and he's still quite a public figure. So even though he lost, it'll be interesting to see what happens with him moving forward. For sure. I think there's still a lot of galvanizing going on for him. And I don't know if he's going to run in 2020, but he might, which could be interesting to see.
Well, it's interesting that another Texan, a Democrat, announced today he's considering running for president, which is Julian Castro, the former mayor of San Antonio, former housing secretary in the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a lot of interesting stuff happening in Texas. You still have Ted Cruz, obviously, with his new facial hair. That's getting him some nice recognition on Twitter. But it's interesting to see how Texas is shaping up, because if the Democrats had won Texas in the midterms, it really just would have shifted our politics on the national level, especially with electoral college votes. So that would have been interesting to see in like a hypothetical situation. But Texas ended up going red.
Flip side of my previous question, who do you think were the big winners in the midterm elections, aside from actually winning seats in Congress?
Yeah, and again, I still think this goes back to a question of representation, right? So even though the Democrats didn't gain as many seats as they had hoped, they gained the right seats, and I think they were able to make a big splash in that respect. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, especially, was the ultimate underdog, and she was able to pull through, which was impressive to me. And she's since kind of just shaken up how we digest politics, right, with her Instagram live stories and kind of like the millennial version of FDR's fireside chats. That's been really interesting to watch just from a like cultural political perspective. So I'd say that she's probably the biggest winner of them all.
It's interesting to see how some of the incoming freshman members of Congress have become celebrities in sort of the realm of popular culture. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a perfect example of that. But you also have Ben Crenshaw. I think he's from Texas as well.
The veteran
who was made fun of on Saturday Night Live. Denver Riggleman from Virginia also got made fun of on Saturday Night Live. This may mean that they have more influence as first-year members of Congress than others might have had in other years.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think what you're seeing is a slightly younger representative body who is more comfortable with engaging with the public sphere, especially in, you know, on social media or using humor to do so, because we've kind of grown up alongside it and are more familiar with it. So the fact that we have politicians engaging with those channels and be willing to work with their audiences and kind of own that space as opposed to have others build it for them is really exciting for me.
We're running out of time, but we haven't even touched on the most continuous story of the year, which is the Mueller investigation and Russian collusion and numerous people pleading guilty or being indicted. What's your take on that, and where do you think we're going to be in a month on that?
Well, that's an extremely huge question to ask, but it's really discerning and interesting. You have Michael Cohen just pleaded guilty and kind of implicated the president while doing so. But this is going to be an ongoing battle, ongoing mudslinging in the media probably as well. And it'll be interesting to see if we can ever actually approach the truth or veracity with that. But I expect this to just kind of continue and trickle on probably up till 2020. I don't know if it will ever actually end.
Final question. What do you think is the most underreported story of the year that we'll be watching in January and February of 2019?
I think the most underreported story is a lot of these climate change reports that are coming out. And I think some other nature group published a story that 70% of all wildlife species have decreased. So I think as we get closer to 2020, I feel like climate change will become a greater talking point moving forward, especially since we're hot off the fires in California. That's a horrible pun.
Well, we'll get together again in a year and find out whether you're right. Michaela, I appreciate your meeting with me today.
No, it's awesome.
I'm really glad you were able to join us on The Score from Bering Drift.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Merry Christmas from The Score with Rick Sincere.
When The Score returns, we'll talk to the Cato Institute's Michael Tanner about his new book, The Inclusive Economy. And we'll hear from National Security Advisor John Bolton's press conference about U.S. strategy in Africa. Don't go away. The Score will be right back.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm Rick Sincere. Earlier this month, the Cato Institute published a new book that looks at how to combat poverty and help people participate in a wealthier economy. It's called The Inclusive Economy, and I spoke to the author, Michael Tanner, and asked him whether we're asking the right questions.
Many people ask the question, what are the causes of poverty? But that's the wrong question. The real question is, what are the causes of affluence, of wealth? Is that correct?
Well, in a sense, man's natural condition is poverty. I mean, we're born into the world naked and hungry. So essentially, we are poor to begin with. And the question is, how do you get out of that? Or what are the conditions that are trapping people in poverty today and not enabling them to get out of poverty?
And that's a good lead-in to the book we're discussing today, The Inclusive Economy, which is written by Michael Tanner, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. That's who we're talking to right now. Give me the 30-second summary of what your new book is about. And it was just published about a week ago, is that right?
It's just out, available in a fine bookstore near you. But essentially, I raised that question of what keeps people trapped in poverty. I think both the right and left have gotten this wrong. On the right, it's largely been a question of the poor themselves, bad decisions they've made, bad choices, not working, not dropping out of school, getting pregnant when you're not married. And on the left, it's been more talk about the structures of society, racism, gender discrimination, economic dislocation, and so on. There's a little bit of truth to both of those issues. But I suggest there's a third villain in this, and that is government policies themselves. Too much of what government does actually prevents the poor from becoming active participants in a growing economy.
In a sense, your third choice is closer to that liberal view of structural conditions causing or maintaining poverty than it is to the conservative view, which is about cultural conditions. Am I misinterpreting that?
Well, there's a little bit of both in there. I mean, certainly you can look at things like need for criminal justice reform, housing laws, and suggest that those things have to do with structures, and they have a history, indeed, of structural racism and so on. On the other hand, you can look at the cultural issues and suggest that government incentives push people in certain directions. For example, the highest marginal tax rates that anyone faces today in America is if you leave welfare and you get a job. You start paying taxes on the first dollar you earn with the payroll tax. You start losing your welfare benefits immediately. You incur the cost of going to work. Naturally, we push people away from work and towards being on welfare.
So what are the kinds of conditions that government should create to promote the escape from poverty?
Well, first, we need economic growth. Nothing has lifted more people out of poverty than a growing economy. You know, throughout most of mankind's history, people were desperately poor. And then along came modern industrial capitalism, and that's lifted most of mankind out of poverty instead. But that economic growth needs to be inclusive, and that means we need to remove government barriers to people participating in the economy. Things like occupational licensure laws, occupational zoning, a minimum wage law, things that get in the way of the poor getting into those first jobs, starting small businesses, starting up that first rung on the ladder to economic success.
Recent polls show that a lot of young people in particular are finding a new attraction to socialism. And you've got people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez elected to Congress on a democratic socialist platform. But socialism is probably the greatest poverty trap that government can create.
One doesn't have to go far to see that people under most socialist countries have lived in abject poverty. In addition to that, you can't redistribute that which doesn't exist. If you raise taxes and regulations to a point where you kill the goose that laid the golden egg, where you no longer have economic growth, where people are not willing to take risks and invest and create jobs, then you're not going to have anything to lift people out of poverty with.
I've got your book right next to me, and it looks very thick. So I want to ask, what are some of the specific suggestions you make, recommendations you make that government should do to promote the kind of wealth creation that you're talking about?
Basically, I put forward a 5-point plan to get people out of poverty. Number one is criminal justice reform, the over-criminalization of our society. Leaves people trapped in ways they can't get jobs and support families. If you commit a crime and you're 20 years old, you get a criminal record that makes it very difficult for you to get a job when you're 30 or 40. It takes fathers out of the families and contributes to the rise and growth of women having children outside of marriage. Second, we need educational reform. The educational public school monopoly exists primarily to serve teachers and administrators today, not parents and children. It's not preparing young people for the jobs of the future. The days when you could get a, you know, drop out of high school and go down to the factory and get a job that supports your family are gone forever. They're not coming back. What we really need to do is have an innovative education system based on competition, choice, parental control. That's the way we're going to raise people out of poverty there. We need to look at regulations that affect housing costs, like zoning and land use, that can add 10, 20, in some communities even 50% to the cost of rents. Locking poor people into marginalized ghettos and unable to move to areas that have more jobs or better schools or less violence. We need to look at laws that block people from saving. The fact is that welfare as it exists today encourages consumption. If you get your welfare check and you spend it all, we're fine with that. But if you put some of that money away to save, to buy tools for a business or so your kids can go to a better school, we're going to take away your check. We sort of have the incentives all wrong. And then lastly, and most importantly, as I mentioned earlier, we need to have inclusive economic growth. We need to have economic growth to begin with. That means low taxes, low regulations. And then on top of that, we need to get rid of those barriers, those hurdles that actually prevent poor people from getting into that economy, things like occupational license, zoning, and minimum wage laws.
Some of the issues you just brought up, some of the proposals, even in this highly polarized political environment we've got today, have broad bipartisan support, like criminal justice reform, occupational licensing reform. Even President Obama talked about that.
Well, I'm hoping is that this provides actually a platform for sort of cross-ideological, bipartisan, look at a different way of dealing with poverty. Right now, we've sort of hardened our debates into this sort of sterile thing where one side wants to raise spending by $1 billion and the other side says, no, we're going to cut spending by $1 billion. We end up doing absolutely nothing. I want to get away from that sort of dollar-based debate and have a debate that's actually talking about things that we can do that does more than prevent people from starving, but it actually enables people to become in control of their own lives, to be self-supporting, to take care of themselves and their families, and to be part of the economy.
I know the book's only been out for about a week, but I was wondering what kind of response you're getting. Any reactions from readers, reviewers, critics?
Well, we know it sold very well, surprisingly. The day it came out, it was number one in social sciences. Today, I think it's number one in macroeconomics. So there certainly has been some interest in it.
So people are buying the book on Amazon and other online sites?
It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, of course, all those things from Cato itself and at local bookstores.
Well, Mike Tanner, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. I really appreciate your talking about the inclusive economy, and I hope you have good luck selling the book.
Well, thank you, and happy holidays.
Thanks, and Merry Christmas to you.
Happy holidays from The Score with Rick Sincere.
Last week at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, Ambassador John Bolton, who has been White House National Security Advisor since April, unveiled a new U.S. strategy toward Africa. After delivering remarks to a group of diplomats and policymakers, he answered questions from the news media in a brief press conference. Here's Ambassador Bolton.
Good morning, Ambassador. Steve Herman from Voice of America. Wondering if you could tell us as far as who's going to get what in Africa, who's going to be specifically in the U.S. government making those decisions? Is there going to be sort of a line item where you or the president are essentially deciding, or is it a more holistic general process?
There's a budget process we're going through right now in compiling the president's fiscal year 2020 budget request. The aggregate numbers are built up from the bottom, so country allocations for the various kinds of economic assistance and security assistance, economic assistance primarily from state AID, food aid from the Department of Agriculture, security assistance primarily from the Department of Defense, and OMB will be using the principles that we've developed in the foreign aid review that I mentioned during the speech. The foreign aid review itself is not quite done. We didn't quite make it on the budget cycle, but we know 90% of what the conclusion is. And so those considerations are being factored in now. So I can't really give you the kind of answer that you like, but when the budget, when the president's budget request comes out, that's when you'll see the outcome of it.
All right. Nick?
Ambassador, Nick Schifrin from PBS News Hour. Thanks for doing this. As you know, these African countries are accepting Chinese technology and infrastructure, even countries like Nigeria and Kenya that are relatively advanced, because they want the technology and they want the infrastructure, and they believe the U.S. isn't competing. So how do you respond to that? And also, AFRICOM has been asked to cut 10%. What message does that send while you're trying to increase emphasis on that?
Right. Well, look, the way the Chinese are doing this, and it's been very successful in places like Sri Lanka, the Maldives, I mentioned Djibouti, and Zambia in Africa and other countries, is they come in with projects. They have very attractive financing in the early years. But the terms and conditions of the projects as they accumulate get more and more onerous, and countries find themselves having been attracted, quite understandably, by initially attractive financial terms, find themselves in more and more difficult straits. So there's a little bit of bait and switch in what China's been up to, and part of what we've been trying to do is make this clear that that the way we do business is much more straightforward. But you have to both do the math and understand what's behind it. And I think it's not that they need any help from us. The developing countries all over the world are increasingly worried about this Chinese approach. I think you saw it very graphically recently at the APEC meeting in Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea, where the Vice President represented the United States. And I think you're going to see more of that across Africa. So this is part of the reason that we felt that we needed to make it clear that the United States did have a high priority on Africa. We approach it very differently than our peer competitors do.
And AFRICOM?
Yeah, look, the military is reallocating budgets on a worldwide basis to try and meet a growing range of threats. That's why I emphasize in the speech things like the G5 Sahel Joint Force. What we'd like to do is empower the African countries to do more of their own security, to do it in coordination with one another. They're the ones who know the neighborhood, rather than have the deployment of American forces who are comparatively very well paid and well equipped. We're not going to be in a position, as we're not in the Middle East, where you've seen rotation of forces away to the Pacific and other places. But those kinds of decisions don't reflect a lack of priority. They reflect, I think, a changing way of trying to do business to give the help that we're uniquely capable of giving to the countries that want.
Thanks.
I'm
behind you, actually.
Sorry.
That's good.
I also have two. You explicitly mentioned China and Russia repeatedly. On the first one, the president called off his meeting with Vladimir Putin recently where they might have talked about some of these issues. Are there any plans to reschedule that meeting?
No, and the president, I'm just going to relate this to Africa, but it's about as close. It's close, but you're hanging by a thread. I made it clear to my counterpart in Moscow right before the president announced on Air Force One he was canceling the meeting with President Putin that we simply could not have the previously scheduled encounter as long as Russia still held the Ukrainian ships and crews. President ran into Vladimir Putin at the dinner that President Macri of Argentina gave for all the G20 countries the first evening of the G20 meeting, and he made the same point. It's something that the president feels strongly about. I've spoken to the Russians myself on the subject, and that's where we are. So I don't see circumstances in the foreseeable future where such a meeting could take place until the crews and the ships are released.
The second one was on Yemen, which is in Africa. The president said this week that he'd be...
Take a shot, see how close you come this time.
The president said this week that he would be open to looking at legislation that would pool support for the war in Yemen in response to the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. But then there was language added to a bill yesterday that blocked it, and I just wanted to know how that war fits into the strategy and whether or not...
I don't think you made it across the line.
Do you have any questions?
Yes, sir. Thanks for listening. Getting back to what you talked about earlier, and this might go back to the previous administrations quite a bit, but why was the U.S. so much slower than Russia and China to see the strategic importance? What was the flaw there? What did we miss?
Well, I think it's been an uneven performance by the United States, an uneven appreciation of Africa. Certainly, we saw in the case going back to the Bush 41 administration with the intervention in Somalia at Thanksgiving in 1992 to open channels of humanitarian relief there. It wasn't that the continent was ignored. It was simply that it did not fit coherently into an overall American foreign policy. I think China, it's very understandable what they're up to. And that is they have systematically tried to monopolize natural resources, in particular in countries all around the world. The One Belt, One Road initiative is a multi-decade-long project. One could say that China thinks over a longer strategic period than we do. Americans have the vices of their virtues. We're an impatient people. It's one reason we are the country we are today, but it has downsides that you don't necessarily think in longer-term strategies. I think the Russians are much more opportunistic. I think this has to do with Putin's desire to reestablish Russia as a world player. They've been involved in various African countries before, and this is an effort to get back into the game.
Please. My name is Shabtai Golden with the German Press Agency. I just wanted to ask, is this program going to lead to budget cuts in U.S. foreign assistance to Africa, or is this a reworking, re-strategizing, more effective use of existing resources?
Right. Well, it's a fair question, but my answer is basically the same as the answer to the first question from the gentleman from Voice of America. What the math ends up to be depends on a bottom-up approach. So we're looking at this really in global terms as OMB and the operational departments and agencies prepare their FY 2020 budget request. Obviously, Congress has to appropriate the money, so that could change the direction and levels in some respects as well. And so we don't know. I just literally cannot answer the question until we get to the end of the budget process. And that's nothing new, by the way. That is true every year. That's what makes the budget process so much fun.
But what's your goal? Is your goal to actually lead to reductions when you go into these meetings? What's the mindset?
Well, the budget guidance that the president directed that OMB send out across the board, with the exception of defense, looks overall like a budget cut for the entire government budget. He wants to reduce the deficit and obviously reduce the national debt. But how that works out in department by department and then program by program, we just can't say at this point.
Please,
Ambassador Nick Niarchos from The New Yorker. So I was looking at the Western Sahara, and I was interested what you hope to see there. Do you want to see the Moroccan autonomy plan? Do you want to see a referendum? And I just want you to speak a little bit about personally what it's felt like for the last 27 years seeing this crisis be frozen.
Frustration. And that's referred to American impatience a few minutes ago. I'd like to see this resolved. If the parties can agree on the way forward, that's the preference. I spoke to former German President Kohler, who is the UN Special Envoy now for the Western Sahara. He's spoken to Jim Baker, there are two Americans who really focus a lot on the Western Sahara. One's Jim Baker, one's me. There are obviously plenty of others, but we've worked on this for a long time. I think you have to think of the people of the Western Sahara. Think of the Sahrawis, many of whom are still in refugee camps near Tindouf in the Sahara Desert, that we need to allow these people and their children to get back and have normal lives. So I think there should be intense pressure on everybody involved to see if they can't work it out. You know, being an American, I favor voting, But there are, you know, there this is obviously a long-standing dispute going back to the after Franco's death, when Spain's control over the colonial areas disappeared. So after 27 years, I don't get impatient on a daily basis. I just get impatient when I think about it, and I'm hoping that President Kohler can bring this together.
Neil McCabe, One American News. Sir, many in Congress, particularly Senator Rand Paul, have blocked the Pentagon from moving the headquarters of Africa Command from Kelly Barracks in Stuttgart to Africa. There would be advantages to having Africa Command in Africa. Would you or the administration support moving it there?
Well, I think the Pentagon's been clear for some period of time after AFRICOM was created that it ought to be in the theater that it's responsible for. The reason it's in Germany is because Africa used to be part of the European Command. So it made perfectly good sense to be there. But I think it's not unlike where we put regional commands in other contexts. And so I think the Pentagon's been right on that.
So we have time for two more questions. We're out of time. Yes, Rob Bowie with the Daily Signal. Mr. Ambassador, I wanted to ask, there are over two dozen individual aid programs. How do you envision using those programs as part of the new strategy? Will you be going to Congress to ask for legislative changes, or does the executive branch have the authority?
Well, I think we probably want additional legislative authority on some aspects of the Prosper Africa approach, but we have succeeded in getting the improvements and expansion of OPIC's authority, which is in the Build Act. I think that's very important. We'll look at other ways as well. You know, part of the issue that we'll confront is the proliferation of aid programs across departments and agencies, coordinating them more effectively from the U.S. government approach. But also, as I said in the speech, I think you have to look at part of this as whether and to what extent we want to allocate U.S. resources away from multilateral institutions toward more direct bilateral programs. The argument being they're more effective that way and there's more direct American involvement. But that's an issue we're still discussing.
Please.
Global Television. I just wanted to be clear on whether there's any dollar figure of resources. You've talked a lot about trade, not aid, but I wasn't sure if there was any proposal for financing. And secondly, I think our colleagues in Kenya believe that there was some point country that you were going to be working with for this. Is that the case? And if so, who is it?
Well, I think there are going to be several countries we're looking at. In particular, we're in discussion with a number of African governments now, and I might say other governments around the world on the foreign aid review. Again, the way the budget works is that these numbers, it's not a target number as such. Aid's got a lot of flexibility in how it allocates resources, the State Department does, the Treasury Department in the multilateral area. So people are working through all these changes that we've announced, some we haven't announced, but the consequences of the foreign aid review as well as OMB's budget guidance. And we're at a point where the President's request to Congress will go up, knock on wood, sometime in January, which is when it's supposed to go up, and that's when all of this will be answerable in the public domain.
We have time for one more question. Please, back there.
Did I give short answers?
Elizabeth McLaughlin with ABC News. Do you expect the President to go visit Africa? I know the First Lady made a visit. Is this something that he's going to be prioritizing?
Well, I expect that we'll be able to talk more about foreign travel in fairly short order. I've asked all of the regional directors on the NSC to give me their recommendations for presidential travel for after the first of the year. I'll be reviewing them over the holidays, and we'll go on from there. But I would expect some announcements fairly soon after the first of the year. Yeah.
Great. Thank you, everybody. Appreciate it.
December 15th is the anniversary of the ratification of the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Each year, the Jefferson Area Libertarians celebrate Bill of Rights Day at the Free Speech Wall in downtown Charlottesville. At the 2011 event, the keynote speaker was Robert Trusinski, editor of TIA Daily. He talked about the importance of the Ninth Amendment, and I asked him a few questions after his speech. From the archives, Here's Robert Trusinski.
You were talking about the Ninth Amendment. Just kind of give me a summary of what your remarks were about.
Well, basically, my argument was that the Ninth Amendment is literally the spirit of the Constitution stated. It's the idea that, to go back to what it says that the enumeration of certain rights in this document don't deny or disparage other rights retained by the people. So basically, it's unusual in that it's not really a legal statement, it's really a statement of political philosophy. It says individual rights are the basis of this whole thing, that pre-existing individual rights retained by the people are the essence, and everything the government does has to be limited by that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Off the top of your head, can you think of any important Supreme Court decisions based on Ninth Amendment jurisprudence?
There aren't. And really, there's not really... Ninth Amendment jurisprudence is, in a way, kind of a misnomer, because it's one that really hasn't been used. And I can see the reasons why it hasn't been used. It's because it's so broad and abstract, and it's a statement of political philosophy and not of some very concrete legal thing that somebody can latch onto. I think its importance is more the idea that it's a guide to constitutional interpretation, because it basically says, when in doubt, err on the side of individual rights. They are on the side of individual freedom. And it basically invites the interpreter of the Constitution, including Supreme Court justices, to refer back to the Declaration of Independence and to the Lockean pro-individual rights position in there as the basis for and meaning of the Constitution and as the grounds for interpreting everything in the Constitution.
Okay. I don't want to misstate what you said, but you made an interesting comparison. You said the default position for government is restriction. The default position for individuals is freedom. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, it's the idea that Jefferson has a great quote about how we should trust people to run their own lives, but when it comes to government, he says, let no more be heard of confidence in man, but bind them down for mischief by the chains of the Constitution. Very famous quote, the chains of the Constitution. But it's this idea that, for the individual out there in the world, you should be able to view the world as a field of unobstructed action with only a few areas marked off saying you can't go here. There's armed robbery, assault. There's a few very evil deeds that we're not going to let you do, and we're going to punish you if you do them. But other than that, the field's wide open. You can do what you want. And then for the government, it should be the exact opposite. There should be a few little islands where we say, okay, here, national defense, law enforcement, the courts, these things you're allowed to do, and you can operate in this area, but you're hemmed in around all sides, and the rest of the world is off limits to you, and you can't go there. That should be basically how we look at things in terms of the role, the relationship of the government to the people. And that's what the Ninth Amendment basically tells us.
Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about why the Ninth Amendment was included in the Bill of Rights? Different kind of language than the rest.
There was a discussion here because of what Joe said earlier at this event about how there was this whole debate about the Constitution and should we have a Bill of Rights. And the argument in favor of a Bill of Rights was very strong. It says, we need to have these protections to keep government in check. The one really good argument against the Bill of Rights, and Madison himself, who ended up writing the Bill of Rights, was one of the people making this argument early on. He says, the minute you put this down on paper and say, these are your rights, it invites them to say, okay, those are your only rights, that's all we have to limit ourselves to, and anything else we can do. And that's, the people in government would want to do that. So the argument was, let's not create this assumption that these are the only rights people have. And so to address that argument, it was specifically to address that Madison put that in there. I think it was a suggestion originally made by the Virginia ratifying convention that they came up with the suggested wording that was then fine-tuned and honed and brought down to this. But it was specifically to head off that idea that these are the only rights you have because they're the only ones that are written down.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. Any final comments?
Let me think what my final comment would be. What excites me about today is I think we are seeing a revival of constitutionalism. I spoke tonight about the idea of a constitutional creed that isn't just a series of legal statements in a document, that it's a whole way of thinking about the role of government, a whole way of thinking about the limitations of government and the rights of the people. That constitutional creed is something I see people taking more seriously, studying in more depth, and hopefully reviving the Constitution not just as a document, but as a way of thinking, as a philosophy of government.
Mm-hmm. Did you happen to see President Obama's proclamation for Bill of Rights Day this year?
I did not see it, no.
I found it online earlier today. I was, I was surprised it was there.
I don't listen to too much of what he says. Yeah, because Bill Clinton's president again now, so
yeah,
it's okay.
This is true. Yeah. Okay, well, thanks very much.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the editors and writers at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to come back next week to hear more news, reviews, and interviews. Don't forget to tell your friends about us. And if you want to be part of the conversation on The Score, leave your comments under our weekly podcast on BearingDrift.com. Thanks for listening.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at RickSincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BearingDrift.com.